Downloads of this show are available on Podomatic.com and the Podomatic mobile app.
Hey everybody. Welcome to Into the Dark, the show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. Here, Raider from Brooklyn. We got a good show for you today, so stay tuned. See you on the back end of the theme music.
Skeptic among believers, and the believer among skeptics.
Are you a good witch or a bad witch?
Who are the witches?
Magic, necromancy, and witchcraft.
Wake up! They're all about you! All around you!
They're not always evil.
The often erotic world of the witch.
With an inside knowledge of witchcraft.
It's a sex thing deep down, of course.
Hey everybody, welcome to Into the Dark, a show that takes you to every witchy where and when you've ever wondered about. We've got a great show for you today, and I'm very excited about it. What's fun about today, for me at least, is that this is actually our second to last show that we're ever doing, ever. And I'm really excited that you can be here for this. I'm excited to share this with you, and I'm excited that you've been with me for this entire journey. Or if you're new, hey, welcome to the end of this. Thanks for stopping by. Check out all the old archive episodes. And so today what we're going to be doing is I've got an interview I did with Manny C. Price, who is an occultist and an artist and really just an interesting, fabulous person. And I talked to them. And then we'll be doing the last of our listener questions. Because the next episode, which will be the very last episode ever, I did a wonderful interview with a witch called Dakota Hendricks, and that is going to take up the entirety of that episode. So basically, we won't have time for anything other than that interview and a few goodbyes. So we're going to be doing our last one, but I want to say something. Since we're going to be ending the show, and listener questions will no longer be a thing that you can do because you will no longer be listeners because the show is going to be going away, I just want to remind you that I'm still going to be available to you as a researcher and as a support person and as a resource community. So if you have questions about the occult or witchcraft sometime in the future, maybe you're listening to this some many years away, the thing to do would be to email me at my personal email account, not the show's email account, mine. And I'll get back to you, maybe not as quickly as I would were the show still going on, and I'll hopefully be able to find good answers for you. But that personal email address is cooper.wilhelm@gmail.com. Cooper like the tire, Wilhelm like the ill-fated Kaiser. And please do send me questions far into the future, because I'm not going to stop being a witch just because the show's over, and I'm not going to stop being curious and interested and willing to put my shoulder to the wheel to learn things so you can learn them too. But that's all the future. That's all mildly sad. So let's talk about the present. And the fun thing about the present is I did this interview with Manny C. Price. Now, Manny C. Price is a practitioner of magic and also an occult artist and performer. And they were kind enough to welcome me into their home in the Bronx, which is just full, just studded with wonderful occult art that they have done. And I was very excited and very grateful to be able to talk to them about their magical journey and their art. And I'm very excited to be able to bring that conversation to you. And so as soon as my phone cooperates, it's been kind of a frantic day in terms of getting things to work technically. I almost didn't make it into the shop because we have anyway, so here on Radio Brooklyn is my conversation with Manny C. Price. I'll talk to you afterwards with our listener question, which was about the relationship between magic and mental health, mental wellness, mental illness, and so on. But before that, here's Manny C. Price.
First and foremost, like, thanks for coming on. You grew up, I understand, like, in a magical household. Like, your mother taught you divination. Like, what was that experience like? Was magic sort of like a separate thing that would sort of come up every now and again, or was it just sort of like integrated into your daily life, like in a very...
It was normal routine. It was like brushing your teeth. It was not put out there like, oh, this is anything. It was special. I strike that, in that this is something you don't talk about. It's private.
Yeah.
And...
like you wouldn't tell the kids at school about it.
Right. Okay. There's something that you keep to yourself, and there's stuff that, you know, you could tell others, but my mom was very particular. She knew how to address it. She knew how to explain it, and, like... You know, she would explain to us, like, mommy doesn't want you to do this at school because people don't understand. And, you know, but this is, you know, it's normal for us in our family. There's nothing to be scared of or nothing, you know. That's the way how she presented to us.
Okay. And was there a sense that, so, I mean, your mother was practicing divination a lot of the time. Like, I believe, so you said, you've learned the Spanish tarot from,
yes.
from her?
Yes.
And what differentiates the Spanish tarot from, like, a more... sort of like the other sort of tarot decks that people might have seen out and about?
Well, the way that she taught me with the Spanish tarot,
yeah,
versus like the normal tarot, like the Rider-Waite or the Thoth decks, which everyone at this point, if you haven't picked up the book, you know, should know how, you know, the symbolism works.
Right.
For us, it's more like opening, because it's so abstract and you're focusing not on the imagery, you are, it's sort of like a focus point. You are allowing yourself to open to spirit to talk to you, and things will start popping up. And yes, the imagery could help, but it's not that too important. And yes, there is things associated with the numbers, and there's things associated with the suits and the court cards, but it's not that significant for us. And the layout is different from, let's say, the Celtic cross.
Okay.
It's like 5-7 and then 5, like the gypsy spread. That's one of the spreads that we use. Another one could be a circle spread, and it goes on from there. I would have to show you to explain it. And sometimes, that's the other thing, unlike... you know, other layouts where you read it a certain way, we read it diagonally, backwards, huh. and forwards, and we read it as like a storyboard.
Okay.
So as the cards unfold, we're like, oh, we're seeing now a story unfolding in front of us. And we speak it as though it's a story, like once upon a time, there was da-da-da-da. And then that's how I was taught.
Okay.
And... she says, do you see this little girl? Do you see this, you know, this person? Do you see what they're doing? What do you think they're thinking? What do you think this means? And she would ask me questions like that. And then whatever came to mind, that was what the cards were saying. And she says, you're doing beautiful. You're doing good. And that's how we practice when I was very young.
So it's a deeply intuitive
yes.
way of doing things. That's really interesting. And when did you start doing sort of divination for other people?
I didn't do it until a friend came along and... kind of prodded me to do it, because otherwise I would have just done it for my family and for friends and close network. I would not do it for the public. That was sometime in 2010, 2011.
Okay. And when did that move into like a broader sort of more, like when your friend was poking you, was it just like, please do this for me? Or was it like, you need to start offering this to other people?
To other people.
Okay. And what sort of convinced
because it,
you?
Because it was too good. She was like, you're hitting it on the nail. You got to help people. And I have had that from even godparents, and you know, the reason why you're in this or the reason why you're doing this is to help others. And I do find satisfaction really helping people. Like, it is, I don't know, it's like, I feel so happy. Like,
yeah.
when I see that aha or the epiphany, and yeah. then they actually follow through. Because, like, you can give advice, and, you know, it's worthless. It's like, you know.
And when you're at the other.
Yeah. And... advice is cheap.
Mm.
Advice is cheap. But when you actually see the people go, oh my God, you're absolutely right, and you hit it on the nail, and they see the whole entire picture, like you gave them a different perspective, and they know what to do, and you give them a game plan, they feel more confident. They feel they could conquer the world. And to me, to give that gives me a sense of accomplishment and helps them vice versa. Mm. And I've actually seen people improve because of it.
That's fantastic.
That I enjoy. But if you're going to waste my time, and I see it like you know, miles yeah. away, like if you're going to waste my time.
Yeah. Okay. I mean, you need a receptive audience for a thing. Like, so it's interesting because, like, I didn't think of, I mean, a lot of people do narrative sort of stuff with tarot, like they sort of build it into a larger story. But, like, given how narrative oriented the sort of practice you were learning was, do you think that drew you to, like, because I think there's a tendency in your paintings for those to also be fairly influenced by narrative. I mean, like we were just talking about one that was a depiction of a Greek myth?
Yes.
Roman myth? Yeah, okay.
Greek.
Yeah. Like, do you see... Because I know you also do spirit paintings.
Yes.
Right? So, like, what is sort of the link between the tarot and the painting? Or is there one?
I don't know if there is a link, but I definitely... These are the three things that I work on. Sex, magic, and the... Well, obviously the occult. And, you know, female empowerment and anything to do with kind of helping my sisters. That's the main bulk of my work. Mm-hmm. And I've had women, like, for example, I'm doing this painting right now, and this was word of mouth. It's three girls that came to me, all at different times, and not knowing that the other did something for the other.
Yeah.
And each one was like, can you do this for my friend? Can you do this for this? And the... And one of them had a serious situation, domestic violence.
Okay.
And this was, and when she received it from her friend, she was like, and I've gotten letters back saying, you know, email, you know, saying that I thank you so much for this piece. You have no idea how my life has changed since.
Right.
And to hear that's a sense of like I'm so happy for them.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah, you're doing good in the world with these. What, so like a spirit promise painting, like what, for people who are unfamiliar with that concept, like what differentiates this from like just a painting you would find somewhere?
All right. The spirit, you're talking about the spirit boxes, yes?
I meant the spirit promise paintings, but.
Okay. The spirit promise paintings is like, for example, cause I had, like three or four people come like for the Orishas, like for a Chango or Yamaya, like they will promise them something like saying, like, if you get me this promotion, get me this job, or if you help me buy the house or whatever, I will give you, you know, and it's common in my religion, yeah, that we give we promise the saints, and even my mom has done it, my grandmother has done it, where if you give me this house, the house is yours, and I will buy you, you know, an X foot amount statue, and you'll be outside, and you'll be the protector, the patron of this house, like for example, Saint Anthony. So. Yeah. If you actually go to my mom's house, you see the statue of St. Anthony in the front of her house, and vice versa with my grandmother.
Okay, cool.
That's an example. So when they come to me for promise paintings, that's what they're asking for.
Okay, and you're like doing the paintings with the intention of this being part of that
transactional
system. Okay, cool. That makes sense. But you're also... So spirit boxes. Like, what's...
Okay.
Talk about those. Because also, people who are unfamiliar, what are these things? How do they work? How do you do them? Tell me about it.
Sure. The spirit boxes range anything from keepsakes to, you know, people could use them for whatever. But majority of them use it for, like, traveling altars. So that's what I've been seeing that they mostly use it for. Or working spirit boxes, like, for the Goetic spirits, like Boon, to put him to work. Or... Furfur I did for a particular client because they were having issues in their marriage. It was another one. Boon was for emergency money. Paimond for hidden things. What was the other one I did? I think that was the majority of the Goetic ones that I did for that. There were ones that I did not know their names. Mm-hmm. Like for one particular client, I think it was Vesper.
Okay.
But because it was a mermaid, a merman in the cover. But she would not tell me the name of the spirit. She wouldn't tell me who it was. She just gave me the instructions and I did it. And you can see pictures online of the commission.
So you don't necessarily need to sort of put your own intention into the box.
No, I make it very clear. Mostly because of scam artists and people that are, they don't mean right.
Yeah,
and I try to like... You know, I'm putting my hand up to kind of break away from that. And I make it stay clear. This is for intermediate to advanced. If you're a beginner, please don't buy. I don't mind giving you instructions and you tell me what you need and whatnot, but if I need to hold your hand through the entire process.
Like, this isn't for tourists.
No.
Yeah. But, like, it's, you also do, I mean, you do a lot of paintings that are not necessarily spirit realms paintings. They're just paintings that you're doing that are still in some way influenced or inspired by these interests. I mean, like, we're sitting, like, right now, even though you can't see it, oh, person listening right now, like, we're sitting in a room surrounded by these paintings, and there's, like, one of, that seems influenced by the Sun tarot card, but also has what would seem to be a, is that a Buddha in the...
Yes.
In there? Yeah, so there's a Buddha in the...
You want me to talk about that one?
Actually, now that I've just... Because I just caught my eye, but yeah, actually, do you want to? Could you?
That one, when my son... Before my son was born, this was in Atlanta, and I told this to my girlfriend, and it was weird because I think it was like a day or two later, my girlfriend came to visit me in Atlanta, and she said, "Girl, you're pregnant." And I said, "You are effing with me. Don't even go there," because we've been trying for many years.
Yeah, yeah.
We're talking about 10, 11 years we were trying.
Wow, okay.
And the previous night I had, I wouldn't call it a vision, maybe it was a dream, I don't know what it was, but I saw glowing, you know how you see orbs in photographs?
Yeah, yeah.
I see them actually.
Okay.
Like, the way I see you.
I've never heard of that before for someone. That's cool. That's super cool. Okay.
And from what I saw, that energy, whatever it was, and I dismissed it, I was like, okay, either I'm half asleep, I'm whatever, I dismissed it. But I saw what looked like what you see there, like a baby Buddha.
Interesting.
And he was just floating in, and it was like it came in floating, like you know how like a firefly comes in and then it turns off and then turns back on.
Okay, yeah,
that's
yeah.
how it was moving.
Okay, so like less of reappearing and disappearing,
yeah, in different like parts of the room,
flashing the path. Okay, that's really cool.
So I said, whatever that is, I'm just gonna dismiss it. And then my girlfriend came the next day and she said that, and I was like, I didn't believe her. And then I think it was a week later, I started throwing up. And, I was pregnant.
I just had this moment of terror because I forgot that that's just a common symptom of pregnancy. I was just like, wait, but what were you sick with? It's like, oh, right, babies, right.
And that's why I did the tarot card painting that way.
Yeah, that's great.
And the model is my son.
And then you also, I mean, your subject matter will branch out into things like, I mean, there's also, like, H.P. Lovecraft himself seems to be over here.
Yes.
Right now.
That was for the Lovecraft Bar.
Right.
And it was there for quite a while, since the a year after their opening. It was up in the bar, I think, for, what, 2-3 years? Yeah. Now it's home. I don't know what the owners are doing. I know there's a change of the guard, and they have, they're doing their thing. I don't know if it's even going to stay. I don't know what's going on with them.
That's...
But they told me one day, hey, they called me on Easter, and they said, hey, we need you to take all the paintings down. And I was like, who's this? And it turned out it was the brother of the owner, and
No, that's not good. That's... Because that, I mean, that space has been such a great place for just, like, art. And, like... performance and stuff, like, that's a shame.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, who knows? If it's uncertain, maybe things won't change that much. Though, I guess this isn't...
I'll probably hear something on the 27th. That's another thing. I'm having a show on the 27th in Chelsea. This is called The Set. It's presenting it, and Pim, I think, is one of the coordinators.
Okay.
And he's also one of the coordinators at the Lovecraft Bar, so he might know more than I do. But that was the information I was given at the time.
Okay, cool. Well, this it's possible that this won't actually go out until after that, but I'll definitely tell everybody in the next episode about that show. So the ultra space you have here set up is interesting because, I mean, you've got St. Cyprian up there.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got, it looks like the Virgin Mary, though I'm not entirely sure.
Nope.
Who is that?
That's Yemaya.
Who is, I'm actually unfamiliar.
That is the Brazilian one version that I have of her statue. She is the Orisha, the mother of oceans, the mother of fish, the mother of all. And she's our family patron, Orisha. She's ours. And as long as I can remember, she belongs to my grandmother, my great-grandmother. It goes far, far, far back. If you can't tell, I'm Puerto Rican. My father was white, though. He was Irish-Scottish. And when I was going through the process of initiation, I haven't finished. But when they started the beginning of it, they explained to me that my Bóveda is not like other people's because of several reasons. One, my ancestors. My ancestors are literally from all over, and they need to be separated and elevated in a certain way. And the staircase, they said, you need a staircase Bóveda, because they come from the seven continents, they come from the seven seas, and that's what it's referring to.
Okay.
When I finally did my DNA test.
Oh, yeah, the 23andMe kind of thing?
Yeah. All anything was missing was Pacific Islander and South Asian.
Nice.
That was the only thing missing. I have Native American, I have African, everything. It was the only thing that came out, like, like 30% was the Irish. Everything else was like 2, 5, 8, 7. I mean, it was it was ridiculous.
Cool. So this initiation process you're going through right now, can you talk about that, or is that like a secretive kind of?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. Fair enough.
I can talk about certain things, like what most people could probably get on the internet, and even that is dubious. They even tell us, like, please don't look for any information. Because what one clan or one tribe or one house does is going to be different from another. Mm. And because of, you know, the Caminos or the Pactis or whatever, like, everyone's going to have their take on what the Orisha or their household spirits or their court or their spiritual court is. And because it's an oral tradition.
Right, right. So it's a very, like, one-to-one, like, someone, I presume someone is, like, telling you the things. Like, the secrets are being given to you by a human being with their voice, as opposed to, like, here's the book or something like that.
Right.
Okay, cool. That's still really
constant. And that's how it's always been done, especially because, you know, it's the spork religion. It is, right. You know, the whole thing of secrecy is because this way Master doesn't find out and kill you.
Right, yeah. Especially in, like, the sort of enforced Christianity of a lot of the sort of colonial assets of the Caribbean and all that. Is there anything that I haven't brought up that you, like, would really like to talk about since you have this space? Or is, like, anything, like, if you had to give a piece of advice or some sort of, like, message to people who are interested in the occult and in magic and becoming, in doing magic, like, is there anything you'd want to, like, tell them? Maybe something you wish someone had told you, like, 10 years before or something like that?
Like I said, and you know, I grew up with this, but for more of the Western-type magic, like the Grimoires, the Lesser Key, whatever, that is sort of part of it, because they do dabble in it, and we do use it for, like, you know, we use it for root working, for example. So there's, like, this, where is it, you know, the whole chicken and egg, where does it begin and where does it end, like, you know, because they've been using it for so long. But no, that sort of helped me branch out into ceremonial magic, and that's the main thing that I've been working on, is ceremonial magic, working with, I would say, celestial beings or demons or intelligences. I wouldn't call them angels.
Okay.
I don't know, it just seems like the wrong word.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of baggage with the word angel.
That too, yeah, but it's when you actually start interacting with the spirits, you realize what they are and how they, you know, like it has to do with the interaction. That's what I feel.
What kind of, like, if you could describe what they are, that's, like, not exactly...
Like Barakriel. Barakriel or Bariel, like, because he comes in different aspects. Here's an example. Like Uriel. Uriel, for the most part in Christianity, everybody knows what he probably looks like, his associate, and whatever.
Yeah.
If you look in the, you know, John Dee, he even says it. I have a child that's a demon. I have another child that is an intelligence. I have another child that, or if I merge with this other angel, I become the angel Anael. I mean, you know, you start thinking in terms of that, like, wait a minute, if they merge, like...
these aren't discrete human bodies we're talking about.
Right.
Wings. Okay.
And they actually became a whole different entity or a whole different spirit.
Yeah.
And then that concept didn't, you know, when you actually start working with them, you realize, oh, okay, you don't have it figured out. And the way they explain it to you, it's so far out there and abstract, you know, like, you can't think in Christian terms. Because that you have to think... outside the box with that. And and that's sort of what he has helped with.
HP?
Yeah, with when you read his writings and stuff like that, you know, kind of like, for example, like Shub-Niggurath, you know, the goat and the mother of, you know, 1,000 young. She's not a goat. She's described as a black cloud.
Yeah.
That's just an example.
Right. That's really interesting. And, like, with ceremonial magic, like, how are you sort of entering into a community with that? Like, is it similar to your initiation... otherwise, or is that, like, are you going out and finding, like, books? Like, how are you getting into that?
When I first started, it was at Enchantments. That was in 2002, 2003, when I was in college.
Uh-huh.
At the time, Joe and Jezebel were working there, and I was going to their classes and the OTO meetings and stuff like that.
Okay.
I think it was 2005 or 2006, because they left at a certain point, and... enchantments did a change of the guard as well. They changed owners. I think they're now in Massachusetts. They did their own thing, whatever, and now they had to move the location. So everything had changed over the time. So I basically lost touch with those people.
Yeah.
So, but I've been continuing my studies, been continuing my working privately, okay. But I still have those connections and like Long Milo Duquette Melissa from Catlin Books and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. And if somebody wanted to get into ceremonial magic, do you have any like good places for them to start besides like their local OTO or like magic?
Well, obviously the lodge. Mostly where I started was Duquette. I know everyone will laugh at that, but so that was my good starting part. And I think it's a good starting point because fear's the mind killer, you know? Yeah. I know. Yeah. Let's be real here. Because when I hear it all the time that everybody's like, oh, I don't want to do demons. And I'm like, oh, washing my face.
Well, it's because they're like doing the Christian understanding of like demons as opposed to like daemons or whatever, you know? Like,
for example, I did my first ceremony doing it for Paimon, and I expected the worst. Yeah. And I had my sword on my lap and everything. And that was the worst way to go. And it was an unpleasant situation, but it could have gone better.
Yeah.
Could have gone a lot better.
Yeah.
And when I redid it with a different mindset and realizing, oh, that wasn't so bad, you know, for example, Paimon, he's a businessman. He is, going to the mafia. It's like, hey, what do you got for me? What do you got, you know, what can you give to me? What interest can you provide me?
Yeah.
And, you know, let's do a contract. As long as you stick to the contract, give what they want,
yeah,
and vice versa, and everyone's happy.
Yeah.
Because I haven't had any problems since.
Yeah.
And that's the way you should, you know, approach spirit. Very business. Like, if you're only using them... That's the other thing that I get upset is, like, my sister hates that I use the word spiritual Pokemon, but don't collect them all. Don't collect spirits, like, you know, have a relationship with them.
Find your
now, that's my, if I had to give a piece of advice to anybody, is have a relationship with spirits. Stick with one spirit. Have a beautiful relationship with them. They'll refer you to other, it's like a network. It's just like the living world. There's networking. You have, you know, your main friend. He's going to refer you to, you know, his spirit friends and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And that's how it works.
Okay. Thank you so much for agreeing to speak with me about this stuff.
No problem. Is there any other questions you have for me, or
questions? Oh god.
Like I said, I have a whole bunch of stories, including for that one over there, the painting.
Oh gosh. I mean, if you could, you just describe the painting, and then we'll leave people wanting to know the context, and we won't tell them because I like the mystery of that.
All right. The name of the painting is The Rape of Orpheus. It is based on a Greek myth, and it's actually based on a ritualistic eating of raw meat that the Greeks did, and it portrays the, I hope I'm pronouncing it right, the Maenades, the nymphs of Bacchus, and they basically said to Orpheus, come with us, come play with us, come dance with us, come eat and drink with us. And of course he's declined because he's in mourning for his Eurydice, and they see him as less as a man, and as such, because they consider him not even a man, they ripped him apart and they ate him and they raped him.
Yep. And
that is the painting.
And the painting is incredibly graphic.
Yes.
And I'm a huge fan, and apparently there have been conflicts.
Yes.
And
but it's been one of my most controversial paintings.
Such is the way with art. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate this. This has been wonderful. And because it's too late for everyone to go to that show, I hope you were listening to the episode 2 weeks ago when I told you to go to it.
Many thanks to Manny C. Price for talking to me about her journey and her work. And also just inviting me into her home. You know, I don't normally do a lot of interviews in people's homes, and it is really nice to do it. It's refreshing to just benefit from someone's wonderful hospitality. And also, that was the first time I'd ever been in the same room as a chinchilla. And chinchillas are really cool. They're basically every cute thing you've ever seen in anime, but it's alive, and that's wonderful. So if you want to learn more about Manny C. Price and about the things she's doing in terms of performance, in terms of art, or to get one of those spirit paintings, or anything of that sort, you should go to her website, which is mannytheuncanny.com. Manny is spelled M-A-N-I, theuncanny.com. So check that out. And you're listening to Radio Free Brooklyn, and this is Into the Dark. This is our second to last show, which is fun, sort of, because I think goodbyes are more fun than hellos because they have more emotional depth and less fear in them. So we're going to be doing, this is our last listener question for the show, ever. But to remind you, if you have a question later on down the road, you want to submit it to our research department, just send it to my personal email address, not to the one on the show, at cooper.wilhelm@gmail.com. Please do not make me regret publicly saying that email address to people. And our question is a big one. And so I don't think we're going to be able to do a... There's no way to really tackle this in a comprehensive way, but there are things to talk about, and it is an interesting thing to consider. So let's dive into this. And it's, dear Into the Dark, what is the relationship between mental health, mental wellness, and magic? And this is really important because I think the history of magic and the history of mental health are sort of intertwined in a lot of very complex and interesting ways. There is currently a tendency, it's interesting, sort of like they sort of in many ways try to explain the same phenomena and try to provide often treatment or cures for the same sorts of problems. And it's interesting the ways in which one will often be used to sort of explain the other, often to possibly the detriment of the people involved. For example, the Salem witchcraft trials. It's difficult to say, looking back now, what was actually going on there. But we have three sort of broad ideas of what could have been taking place with the symptoms of the young girls who claim to have been hexed by a witch. Now, it's very possible that they were actually hexed by witches, option one. It's very possible that they were faking it, either because they wanted to get people in trouble out of spite, or there's been some suggestion that all the people who were targeted with accusations of witchcraft were landowners, and that these accusations would make their lands available to those who would use them for material purposes. But it's also possible that what was happening, and this is one possible explanation, is that the rye being grown at Salem was infected with a fungus called Claviceps purpurea, which, when consumed by human beings, can produce a number of symptoms similar to those that one might ascribe to a curse or a hex, including feelings of pins and needles, spasms, convulsions, and hallucinations. But there, I think what's important about this is, like, there are a lot of instances where people want to try to say mental health is largely the result of witchcraft, or that witchcraft is merely an interpretation of the symptoms of mental illness. And I think it's important for us, especially as people who are inclined to believe that witchcraft is a force in the world that we can engage in, that we can deal with, that both could be possible in any given situation. There could be a sort of magical thing going on, while at the same time there could be simply the symptoms of run-of-the-mill mental health, mental wellness issues. And so before I go into anything else, I just want to say that, one, witchcraft is here to empower you. It is here to liberate you. So if you find that your delvings into witchcraft are having negative effects on your mental health or mental wellness, it is okay to stop. And that stop does not need to be permanent. It can be temporary. You can put things on pause until you can figure out a more healthy way to go about things. But if you find that your witchcraft practice is hurting you, by all means, stop, because it's here to help. Witchcraft is here to make your life better, not worse. And if you find yourself in a position where you are concerned about your mental health or your mental wellness, please feel free to avail yourself to what I would argue are the sort of, like, empiricist answers to these issues. They may not be helpful for everyone, but like, consider these things. There are certain mental health resources you should look at if you feel that you are in need of that kind of help, and those, there's no shame, there is no stigma, and consider going to either mentalhealth.gov or to the National Institute of Mental Health's website, which is nimh.nih.gov. And you can call the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Administration treatment referral hotline if you want to find a mental health professional that you want to talk to. And that number is 1-800-662-4357. That's 1-800-662-4357. And lastly, just important to get out here, if you are thinking of hurting yourself, if you're thinking of hurting anybody else, please talk to someone about it immediately. Do not wait. And if you're having suicidal ideation, please do call the Suicide Prevention Hotline, which is 1-800-273-8255. The number again is 1-800-273-8255. But having gotten that out of the way, it doesn't have to be either or with mental health or witchcraft. And there are many examples of situations where you could sort of talk about both being at play. An interesting example of this would be the Washington Post ran an op-ed back in 2016 by a psychologist or psychiatrist named Richard Gallagher. And he tells the story of when he was contacted by a Roman Catholic exorcist. And the purpose of his being contacted by the exorcist was basically that the exorcist wanted him to weigh in as a psychological professional as to whether what he was seeing could be explained, what the sort of demon possession that he had been called to consult upon could be explained through simply mental illness of some kind. And it's interesting because this person who I self-identifies as a man of science in the very sort of stiff-collared kind of way, said, quote, quote, for the past 2.5 decades and over several hundred consultations, I've helped clergy from multiple denominations and faiths to filter episodes of mental illness, which represent the overwhelming majority of cases, from literally the devil's work. It's an unlikely role for an academic physician, but I don't see these two aspects of my career in conflict. The same habits that shape what I do as a professor and psychiatrist, open-mindedness, respect for evidence, etc. So, I mean, it's interesting because he basically talks about how most of the time what he deals with does seem to be a question of mental illness, but not always. For example, he says, quote, I was inclined to skepticism, but in one of his initial cases, my subject's behavior exceeded what I could explain with my training. She could tell some people their secret weaknesses, such as undue pride. She knew how individuals she'd never known had died, including my mother and her fatal case of ovarian cancer. 6 people later vouched to me that during her exorcisms, they heard her speaking multiple languages, including Latin, completely unfamiliar to her outside of her trances. So it is worth considering the ways in which you can integrate, if you're thinking of like using witchcraft for things that may be the symptoms of mental illness or maybe the symptoms of some sort of like demonic interference or some sort of bad spirit, it's okay to do both. It's okay to make witchcraft part of your mental health, self-care, and also go to like a traditional sort of therapist. There's nothing wrong with going to therapy. It's really important to remember that also that magic in general has a long history of being used for improving one's mental health and mental wellness, and also for just sort of finding ways to sort of cope with things, sort of train your mind to work in certain ways. I mean, there's certainly the tradition of the ways in which that of considering magic as basically a way of sort of directing your mental processes, directing your mental health towards certain states, like trying to get yourself into an ecstatic state for a ritual or trying to allow yourself to be possessed by some sort of force or figure and take on their mental properties, to the point where someone like, say, Philip J. Carroll, who's a Discordian, would talk about trying to randomize your personality so you could better use it in a directed way for magical purposes. But it's also important to remember that in the history of at least Western magic, there has been this deep consideration of magic that you do for external gain or external purposes, you know, magic to win a lover, magic to get money, magic to cure some sort of physical ailment, but also the magic and magical practices you do to work on your internal state and how you are inside. For example, there's a magical historian named Stephen Skinner, and he talks about the way in which, if you look at sort of the Western magical tradition, you can trace a lot of what we find in the Western magical tradition to a mixture of two things that were basically going on in the Greco-Egyptian world. And those were the quote-unquote magical tradition, which is sort of geared toward these kinds of material changes in the outside world, getting money, finding a lover, etc., but also the mystery traditions, which dealt with sort of expanding and purifying one's soul to deal with magical beings, magical entities, spirits, and so on. And we see these sort of, they were sort of separate traditions in Western magic for quite a long time. So says Stephen Skinner, until the Golden Dawn, which was, of course, the sort of Victorian revival of occultism, tried to put them together through initiation rituals. The idea being that you would go through initiation rituals that in some way tapped into this idea of mystery religions, and you would do that before you learned the grimoire magic to make things happen in the world. And Skinner suggests that these sorts of things, you saw them not only in Western magic, but you also see a very similar tradition in Chinese Taoist sorcery. So there's a lot to be said for the idea of using magic to work on yourself in a self-care sort of way, in a self-actualization sort of way. And there are many spells and resources for this. And so I wanted to go into just one of these, if I might. So here's a spell from the Black Witch Coven for just dealing with depression. And their spell basically tells you to go outside during the day and find a large tree, preferably oak, and to put your hand on the tree, the dominant hand, the hand you use to do things, and say something to the tree that essentially says to the tree that you want to be healed by the tree in the spirit of the tree. Ask for the tree's help in healing yourself, in making yourself strong, and then sit down with your back to the tree facing the sun and relax and sort of feel yourself melting into the tree, becoming one with the tree as though you were a branch full of leafy foliage, and feel the sun beat down on you and drink the light of the sun and feel the love of the sun and feel the wisdom of the tree as you are becoming part of the tree. And then once you've sort of gone through this cleansing and this healing, separate yourself from the tree, become human again, and then face the tree and say thank you. And I think, you know, you'll find a lot of traditions where there's this question of like ways to make yourself feel better in a mental health context that involve acknowledging the issue at hand, asking for help, and then having some sort of closing out, saying goodbye sort of thing. One that a particular ceremony that is very interesting. So Andrew Solomon talks about going to Senegal and undergoing a ritual for depression called the Undup, which actually, if you were listening very closely at the very beginning of this episode, we are playing the pattern, a drum pattern used in that ceremony sometimes. And it's a very complicated ritual. There's a lot going on there, but I think the sort of salient detail for us, I mean, if you want to go through the ritual, talk to a practitioner of Senegalese magic. But, part of the idea of that ritual is acknowledging your depression and then exercising it out of your body. So there is a process by which one's depression is transferred to a symbolic animal, in this case a ram, and then the ram is slaughtered, and then you are to take parts of the ram and bury them. And as you bury them, you are to say to them, spirits, leave me alone to complete the business of my life, and know that I will never forget you. And so you see versions of this in a lot of sort of magic practices, this idea of when you're dealing with mental health issues with magic, you acknowledge the issue as something that you are dealing with, as something that is, in a way, separate from yourself and therefore a thing that you can remove while also acknowledging in its removal as well. It's not just saying I have a problem, it's saying the problem is a thing I have and I want to put it down, and then saying goodbye to the problem as though it were an entity that could understand you. And I think that can be very helpful in ways that, I mean, you know, what, like I'm saying, magic, traditional treatment, or not traditional, but, you know, medically recognized and accepted treatment, these things can work in tandem to improve your mental health, your mental wellness, and just your outlook on things. And I'm not saying one can be used as a substitute for the other, but you can certainly dabble in using magical practices towards some sort of mental health benefit. I mean, another example of this would be, I mean, when I first started getting into magic, personal story, guys, when I first started getting into magic, I often would use the tarot as a form of talking cure, as a way of sort of finding a platform to talk to myself about my own problems and analyze them in a certain way, similar to how one might speak to a therapist or a psychiatrist. Like, if I got the devil card and I thought, oh, the devil card must represent this, I'd think, oh, well, if I think this is what the devil card represents, then clearly I have some sort of anxiety around this thing. So let's focus on that. Let's unpack that without even sort of considering it as like necessarily also a form of divination. Though, I mean, when you start talking about self-analysis and you're using divination to look into yourself anyway, the lines kind of blur between what is divination and what is simply a symbolic act for self-understanding. But it's important also to remember that magic for a long time, for a lot of people, was essentially the medicine that was available to them. And while we can sort of go between magical medicine and pharmaceutical medicine, it is important to also remember the ways in which these two things can interact with each other. For example, if you're going to start looking at ways in which magical herbs or herbs used in a magical way may be able to help you with your mental health and mental wellness, make sure to double check those against any medications you might be already taking. Now, this includes not only psychological medications, but also just standard things like beta blockers, medications for diabetes, things like that. Make sure to remember that these magical herbs do have efficacy within the sort of pharmacological worldview, and that these things are important to consider before combining them. But if you are interested in taking an herbal route to improving mental health, there are a lot of herbs you can use in this way. But a few examples of those for you include sweet basil, which can be used for exorcism, protection, and courage. Bay leaves, which can be used for protection, healing, purification, strength, and divination. And rosemary, which is very useful as an incense for healing, protection, purification, stress relief, strength, and memory. And also consider making a dream pillow out of lavender, which can help with relaxation and sleep. I know I've sort of talked about, I touched on this, but I want to really stress it. There's no stigma in being a witch who also has what might be just considered some level of mental illness. And there's no stigma in considering the ways in which magic may help you if you interpret what's going on as, or identify what is going on as, some sort of magical problem. So it's important to consider the ways in which these two things have overlapped in history. But, I mean, that's basically what I've stepped into with all of my research. The one thing I would add, finally, is that if you are doing magical work and you are concerned about the possibility of running into demonic possession or something like that, it's important to remember that as a magician, as a witch, as a wizard, as whatever you identify as, whenever you're engaging in magical practice, which is very often something that involves generating a certain emotional or psychological state within yourself, it is important to take steps to protect yourself. Now, for a lot of the Western tradition, that means doing things like a magical circle, like the Circle of Solomon. But in certain ways, creating a boundary between you and what you are working with to protect yourself. And this sort of boundary, this sort of question of keeping an eye on yourself and how you are doing, checking in with yourself is very important. Whether that takes the form of making like a Seal of Solomon or simply making a point of maybe during the course of a ritual at every sort of stage and segment, at every sort of separation within that, taking a moment to step back and say, how am I doing right now? Do I want to keep going with this? Is important. It is valid. And I cannot stress enough, take care of yourself, because magic is daunting. Magic can be very hard. And while it can do a lot of good for you, you should never allow it to take you to a point where it is doing you harm. And with that, I think we can basically close out the show. Want to say again, if you are interested in pursuing some sort of treatment, by all means, avail yourself to the resources in your community or at mentalhealth.gov or at nimh.nih.gov. And once again, the suicide prevention hotline is 1-800-273-8255. And if you have listener questions in the future for Into the Dark, even when Into the Dark is gone, please do send those to cooper.wilhelm@gmail.com, and I'll just email you back at some point, hopefully with an answer that is helpful to you. And yeah, so because the show in 2 weeks from now will be the final show, but that final show will be taken up almost in its entirety with an interview, I think it is fitting and proper to take a moment now and say thank you, all of you, for following me on this journey into the darkness. Thank you to those of you who have sent in your questions, who have sent in your comments, and to everyone who took the time to do an interview and talk about their magical journey. And if I've learned anything over these last 2 seasons of doing this show, it's that magic is something that can improve your life greatly, and something over which you can exert a great deal of control to find your comfort level with it. You can determine your level of involvement, and that's not just on a personal level, but also in terms of looking for and finding some sort of magical community that you can be a part of. Let magic be a tool not just for looking to get what you want, but also just for personal empowerment, personal liberation, and for an amelioration of how you're doing. So thanks very much for coming on this journey with me. Tune in 2 weeks from now when I'll be doing that interview with that final interview with the final episode. And as always, keep things as witchy as possible. Stay tuned to more Radio Free Brooklyn. This has been Into the Dark.